Blog Talk Radio.
Rising report, it's that Apple report. It's the Rising Apple report. Rising report, it's that Apple report. It's the Rising Apple report.
Yeah!
And good evening, Mets fans. This is Rising Apple staff writer Rich Sparago welcoming you to the 125th episode of the Rising Apple Report. And today's a very special day. As I'm sure you know, today pitchers and catchers officially reported to Mets spring training in Port St. Lucie. So the sound of that just warms you up, right? So, you know, it's a cold night here in the Northeast, but knowing that there's real baseball going on in Port St. Lucie tells us that the season can't be far behind. And it's really nice to say the following words: the Mets open camp as defending National League champions. I could just say that from now until the cows come home. It just sounds great, doesn't it? So tonight on the show, I'm very pleased to bring on board my fellow staff writer and a voice that we hear quite often on the Rising Apple Report, Mr. Mike LeColant. Mike, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me and hosting this evening, Rich.
My pleasure. Like I said, it not only is it a happy day because it's Mets Pitchers and Catchers Day, but it's also National Drink Wine Day, and wine puts everybody in a good mood. So that's just an added little bonus. And tonight, speaking of bonuses, I have the opportunity to welcome on board to his first ever podcast a brand new writer on the Rising Apple staff, Mr. JT Turan. JT, so this is your first time on, and you just joined us, I think, a few days ago. So why don't you tell us a little bit about where you're from, what your interests are, and how you came about to Rising Apple?
Yeah, man. So first of all, thank you guys for letting me join. This is pretty exciting. It's pretty awesome. I actually just joined, I think it was 2 days ago, literally, and we decided to, you know, do the podcast and get on here. So I wanted to be able to get to know you guys, and I'm very, very happy to be here. I'm originally from Ecuador. I'm from South America, which is, a little far, far away. I moved here when I was little. We lived in Miami for a few years, and then we eventually moved up, made our way to New York. And that's where I became really a Mets fan. In 99, like I was explaining to you guys before we got on the air, that that whole season was just awesome. And even though it ended in a pretty crappy manner, it got me hooked. And obviously the 2000 series the next year and everything just really cemented not only me being a Mets fan, but me being a Mets fan in a family dominated by the Yankee fans. So for my cousins, thankfully my parents aren't, they're Mets fans, but everybody else in my family, diehard Yankee fans. So it's been pretty fun having that rivalry over the years. They've had the advantage most of the time, but I feel like with last year and going into this year, you can feel pretty confident about talking a little bit more smack about the Mets. So I'm happy to join. I love that jingle at the beginning, by the way. As like the intro's going on, I was like just jamming to it. So whoever came up with that, that was freaking awesome.
Well, I think Sam Maxwell is going to be joining us a little bit later, and he gets full credit for that. So Sam is really the mastermind behind the entire concept of the Rising Apple Report, and he, I believe through a friend of his who's a musician, put that together. So we'll be sure to give Sam the kudos when he comes on. And you gave me a really nice...
I didn't mean to turn it up to you, but between that and National Drink Wine Day, I mean, we're about as relaxed and ready to go. It's spring training. Like, this is awesome.
Isn't it, though? And you just gave me an even better setup to where I wanted to go, so thank you once again. So, Mike, I'm going to start with you on this, and let's start with the very top. I'm not sure if you had a chance to see, I actually DVR'd Terry Collins' presser today, and if you didn't see it, perhaps you've heard some of the quotes. But essentially, you know, Terry's talking about how this year it's all about unfinished business, and he's talking about how he wants the team to play with a little bit of swagger, that there's nothing wrong with having the big old target on your back because nobody guns for a loser, essentially. So what he's saying is, you know what, we learned something last year. It didn't end the way we wanted it to end, but we have to be confident that we have a very good team here, play with some swagger, you know, really welcome and embrace the challenge of having that target on your back. So, Mike, what are your thoughts on the tone, whether it's from today's presser or whether it's from, you know, the past few days hearing from Terry? What are your thoughts on the tone being set from the top?
You know what? Good for him. I haven't always been in his corner. That said, good for him. He's speaking like a man who has, A, nothing to lose, B, a man with a lot of confidence and, you know, a positive vision of the upcoming season, and C, a loose cannon, so to say. I don't think he's necessarily interested in, you know, giving the stale quotes this season. You know, what he said about this is a young men's game executive-wise and upper, or I should say front office-wise, this is a young men's game with stats dominating the landscape, et cetera, et cetera. And him being a man of advanced age and, you know, he relies on the eye test. It was refreshing to hear as opposed to all this staleness that we've been receiving from managers, general managers, and front offices over the seasons, not just the Mets, you know, throughout baseball. So, you know, at this stage of the game, I think Terry's getting, he understands he's about to have a lot of fun. I think he's trying to loosen up the environment from the get-go, knowing that, you know, we're on the other side of a rebuild and we're no longer the underdogs. Now we're the hunted. And I think he's going to have fun with that, and I think he's going to, you know, get guys to buy into this notion, you know, all for one and one for all, that, you know, here we are and people are coming at us, so let's enjoy it and relish it and delve into it and win.
That's got to add some pressure, though, right, to the team as a whole unit. I mean, going into 2015, I don't think that pressure was necessarily – there, the Nationals, everybody picked the Nationals not only to win the NL East, but to also win the World Series. So the Mets performed kind of a little bit under the radar, and then everybody says that they surprised in 2015. So do you guys think that mentality will affect their play, the fact that they're defending National League champions and now they have that target on their back?
I think they're chomping at the bit, to be honest with you. It's not like they backed into the playoffs. They clinched the National League East. Yes, the Nationals perhaps underperformed, but they made it through the first round and they made it through the second round and won themselves a pennant. So I think the predominant mindset is that they do, in fact, have unfinished business. Pressure is what you put upon yourself. That said, you know, if you set certain goals for yourself and you set out to achieve them, pressure is a background issue.
Yeah, you know, I agree with that, Mike. And Terry said something else that I thought was very interesting. You know, he said that, and JT, I'm going to go to you next, you know, to certainly expand upon your comments and what you think of Terry's tone. But one thing that Terry said today is he said he had a chance to watch as the Atlanta Braves dominated year after year and had that big target on their back and how they responded to it. He had a chance to watch as the New York Yankees, God, since memory, you know, I've always had a target on their back because even if they don't make the playoffs, which has become a little more common lately, but they're the hunted. So he's observed how teams deal with that, how they almost relish it, how it's not – you have to draw – he said you have to draw the line between cockiness and swagger. Swagger means, you know what, we know we're good. You're going to have to play really well to beat us. Cockiness is something else. Cockiness is something that gets you in trouble. But he did say that he referenced a couple of teams, and he said those are his models for how they were when they were, and in the Yankees' case still are, in this situation of being the hunted. So, JT, why don't you run with this one and tell me what you think of the tone being set.
Well, to be honest, I think the tone being set is perfect. It's not – nobody's surprised. Like it was already mentioned before, the Mets deserve to be exactly where they were in the World Series. They didn't luck out. They dominated. one of the best teams in the National League in the Cubs. They beat the Dodgers. They beat some great pitchers on the way to the World Series. So that it's no surprise, and they should be putting the pressure on themselves. They should have that swagger. I hate that word sometimes just because it sounds stupid, but the idea of being, of having confidence and believing in yourself is something that I think is not only deserved, but they've earned it too. For me, it is a question of whether that'll help them along the season, or whether it will, or whether some of these guys will be affected by it. I mean, I look at a guy like Noah Syndergaard, and he's the epitome of what you want on your team. He's talent-wise, amazing, but he also wants that pressure. He wants to have the ball. He loves the Mets, and he likes the spotlight, and he likes being the way that he is. And you have Harvey on there too, who, I mean, has just proven time and time again that he's able to handle the pressure. So am I worried of it? No, I'm not, because I think this is definitely a better team. It's a deeper team than anything we've seen in recent years. But being a Mets fan, you obviously always think about the last failures. And I automatically think about the 2007 comparison. Coming off a great year in 2006, you think about 2007 and what happened. Obviously, totally different teams. Like I said, this team is a lot deeper, so it can handle a better it can handle just different situations that are thrown at it. But being the Mets fan and having that Mets curse put on you mentally just always makes you wonder. So, I mean, that's how I personally feel about it. I think once we get the season rolling and it starts clicking how we expect it to, I'll personally be able to calm down a little bit more.
Well, and I think that goes back to what Mike said, is that the fact is they are National League champions, and the fact is they have a right to play with swagger, whatever the word might be, because of those achievements. Now, what they do with that is really a function of them as individuals. I mean, if they choose to be nervous about it and let it get to them, which I don't see happening, that would be one thing. But if you choose to embrace it and use it as almost like a weapon, then that's the other option, and that's certainly the one that I hope that they use. So I'd like to bring on, I believe I have Sam Maxwell, the aforementioned and accoladed Sam Maxwell. I believe I have Sam Maxwell on. Sam, how are you tonight?
Hey, everybody. Welcome, JT. Glad you can make it out on your inaugural week with Rising Apple.
Yes, sir. Glad to be here.
So, Sam, we were just talking about how you're the mind behind these podcasts. We mentioned that earlier on. And now what I'd like to do is throw that first question at you that we've all been talking about, which is your thought on the tone being set from the top. You know, Terry talking about playing with swagger, playing with confidence, being the hunted, embracing that. What are your thoughts on that? Do you like the tone being set?
Yeah, I wasn't able to really monitor it throughout the day, but I right before you asked the question, I was actually reading some of the summary of Terry Collins' the things that he said today. And yeah, absolutely. I think that the bottom line is, you know, I think one of the things I really liked about it was, you know, focus on the game at hand. Don't focus on November. Don't focus on last year. It's a new year. And to be honest, I think if they go about it with the swagger and the confidence and not have cockiness about it, there could be a chance. I mean, I think somebody said it on this podcast before that, you know, we're not looking at, like, you know, best-case scenario, they could win 82 games. Best-case scenario, they can maybe squeak in. You know, best-case scenario, this team could dominate. So I think you need to set this type of tone early on. This is where it was set last year, if you remember. I mean, you know, even though they kind of still, by the end of it, crept up on some people, they had confidence, and they set a tone with everybody in camp, including Noah Syndergaard. Remember the whole lunch incident with Bobby Parnell and David Wright and him. You know, this is when it's all laid down. This is when the foundation is set. And, you know, I can't really say that, like, it's that much different necessarily from, you know, thinking about, like, 2009 what was his name, Razor Shines, talking about, you know, you're not going to win a ring that way, you're not going to win a ring that way. There's different ways of going about it, and there's so many different details that we don't even get to see. But based off of, like, talking about last year, compared to this year, we know what spring training is for, and yes, I think this is the perfect tone to set because they need to keep their head level and go about winning baseball games early.
Hey, Rich, consider this, and you and I have been there. The 1985 Mets accomplished less than the 2015 Mets. Yeah, Davey Johnson was the man who came out in spring training of 86 and said, this team is going to dominate. So how's that for setting the table?
Well, Mike, spot on, because I have used that example, I think, two or three times on the podcast. I could not agree more, obviously, that after the 85 season, but basically, for those younger listeners, what Davey said was, we were beaten, we think we were the better team in 85, Cardinals beat us, fine. This year it's us. We have unfinished business. It was the same kind of tone. You're right, they didn't achieve as much, but it was the same tone. It was, we're the team to beat now. Come after us. Come get us. That kind of a thing. So I think that is the closest analog in my Mets fan history to what's going on here. The same tone that I'm seeing this spring is the tone that was set in that going into 1986 spring. I can only hope the results of the season are the same. And speaking of Terry the manager, I didn't really want to do this tonight, guys, and I really mean that. But if you watched Terry's press conference, he talked about it, so I'm going to say it. I'm going to throw it out. And if you have something to say about this, go ahead. I'm not going to call names. Just say what you want to say, or maybe you just want to let this be. But Terry talked a lot today about Game 5 of the World Series. He talked about how he put up a bravado that it only bothered him for a couple of days and he was over it. He said it bothered the living heck out of him for a very long time, his decision to leave Matt Harvey in the game. So, you know, he brought it up, so I brought it up. Do you guys, and maybe this will be the last time we talk about it on the podcast, so who has a comment on that? Does anybody have any final comments on that decision, whether it's about that game, or does it maybe give you a little bit of pause about Terry in a big spot? Any comments from any of you guys on that?
I mean, you know, I'm always the guy to go to, I guess, about Terry Collins, so maybe I'll start. I think it's no longer Murphy give us, Murphy take us away. Terry Collins can take that tone. I think that Terry Collins, he made it all the way to the World Series. And mind you, some of the decisions that we were thinking were going to bite us in the ass did end up biting us in the ass in terms of the way Terry Collins goes about managing or sometimes oddly lack thereof. But I still, right now, I can't argue that he's not the right man to finish the job. I think that he's really, right from the get-go, there was that whole thing about the way he's not a player's manager, about the fact that there was a coup d'etat, there was a mutiny back with the Angels, and from, you know, all we hear now is how open he is to listening to his players, communicating with his players, talking appropriately without coddling them. That's another stuff that he talks about today. So Terry, even though I think I will continue to question some of the moves he does during the game, I can't really say that he doesn't learn from his mistakes. And so if there's any consolation I can take from Game 5 of the World Series is that Terry Collins is a better man, he's a better manager going into the season, and hopefully that's the case.
I like it. It's a positive spin on it. JT or Mike, anything to add?
You know me,
I'll go
Rich.
First, if anything.
Go for it, JT.
Sorry, boss. I didn't mean to cut you off. It was one of those decisions that I think it was, if I don't really believe in a destiny type of scenario, but it was one of the closest things to making me believe in destiny than I've ever had, like I experienced in my life. Because every single one of us, when Harvey finished the eighth, unanimously thought he has to go back out for the ninth. He has to go back out for the ninth. There's just no question about it. And then that happened, and you're just like, okay, like the Royals are just destined to win this thing. There's just absolutely nothing that anyone could have done about that. I firmly believe that if he would have taken Harvey out in the eighth and brought Familia into the ninth, the Royals would have somehow been able to score the runs needed to win that game anyways. So it's almost like I can't fault Terry for that. The decision that gets me more mad, and maybe it was because I was at game four, was the eighth inning bringing Tyler Clippard in and not yanking him after he walked that first batter. That, to me, hurts, and that, to me, bothers me more than him letting Harvey out in the ninth, because I almost feel like even if you would have had to try to take him out, you would have had to rip the ball from Harvey's hands. He was just not coming out of that game. And I know it'll bother him, and I'm sure it bothers – Harvey even said that it bothers him still. So, but it's just – that's what happens, and that's why you play the games, and unfortunately that's just how it is sometimes, and I'm glad it's haunted them because it'll give them fuel for this year. That's my take on it, at least.
Fair enough. Mike?
JT uttered the magic words, just play the game. You know, that's what makes sports / baseball so compelling. It's not a predetermined outcome. You have to play the game. Look, I think it was last or the second to last podcast, I summed up my whole philosophy in four sentences. And here they are. A, players win championships. B, great teams minimize managers. C, sometimes great players need good managers. And D, great managers manage blindly. You know, just so stick with your convictions. That's what I want from my manager. Just stick with your convictions. I don't want to ponder whether Terry Collins got talked out of that scenario, and we're talking about pulling Matt Harvey or not. So that's it. I'll just leave it at that. Just manage with conviction. The great ones do so blindly. They don't care who they're pulling, so long as they feel they're making the right move.
He'll never make the same mistake again, though. He'll never leave Harvey in again in a scenario like that with a big game on the line. I don't think he makes that same choice again.
You know what? You're right. And now the next time he goes out to the mound in a pressure situation like that, he'll have ammunition to look Harvey in the eye and say, you know what? Beat it, kid. Hit the shower. You did your job. Get out.
I mean, exactly. Here's my thing. Are we talking about specifically that type of scenario? Because what if, like, you know, basically the tying run could be, like, two or three ball players, base runners, from being up. I mean, is that basically the situation? You know, I forget exactly how many pitches he had at the time. I think it was like 102. But, you know, I guess we can never say never in some fashion. Does that make sense?
It does. I think what you're saying, Sam, is that it has to be situational, and it would be equally wrong to overreact to that decision, making the other decision all the time without regard to context. And I do think you're onto something there. And I'll leave this at this point. I'll leave this point with this one comment. Tom Verducci wrote an article in SI. It was in the edition 2 weeks ago. A work colleague of mine puts it on my desk and he says, I'll just leave this here. You need to read this. And the name of the article was, This is What Terry Collins Was Thinking. And the part that really spoke to me was, what Terry knew when he went out to the mound was that Harvey's batting average against when he's over 100 pitches in 2015 was 347. 347 batting average against Harvey when he was over 100 pitches, and he left him in the game. And Terry in the article, he talks about heart and head and all that stuff. To me, that's just noise. When your season's on the line and you know that your pitcher gives up a batting average of 347 against over 100 pitches, how in the world do you make that decision? And I could only hope that, like JT said, he's learned from it, that he'll let the numbers drive those decisions in the future. And it's funny, and I'll part with this, and we'll get into spring training, that Terry, if you saw his comments at the end of Hot Stove tonight, he said that it's a young man's game, and he used a lot of expletives saying that, you know, OPS, GPS, good blanking players, you know, win games. I don't worry about that stuff. So it does kind of seem like Terry might be seeing the end of his managerial career, at least in the fairly imminent future. So let's hope they have a World Series for him this year after last year. That'll help him retire with a clear head, and I really hope it happens for him and for us. So moving on to spring training. So it's interesting. You know, things are pretty quiet in Port St. Lucie. We're not screaming about go get a center fielder like we did before the 2013 season. We're not screaming about this or that. It's basically a very quiet, business-like camp. But let's talk about a few things that have popped up. And let's go to JT. I'm going to give you a chance to lead off on this one. One of the things they're talking about is potentially using Kevin Plawecki and or Travis d'Arnaud at other positions, possibly first base, maybe a little third base. So, JT, I'm going to let you run with this one. What do you think about that? I mean, are you a fan of saying, look, hey, you know what, why be so limiting and make these guys just catch? It's a chance to get both their bats in the lineup at the same time. Are you all for it, or are you kind of against that idea? What do you think?
Well, I think the fact that Wright is his goal for this year is 130 games, if I'm not mistaken, right? So we're looking at having to have another somebody fill in for another 32 games, and obviously, you know, people can split that up. But the idea of at least giving them a shot in spring training, I think, is a no-brainer. You have obviously these games that just mean nothing. So try it out. I think it would be preferable in third base over first, unless you want to give Duda some chances. But Plawecki seems to be a better defensive catcher, at least throwing the ball. Darno has had his struggles. So what I like to give, I think I would prefer giving Darno a chance over Plawecki, just to try to, you know, see if he can do well in at first or at third. How that's going to go, I think, is a completely different question. But why not? I don't think it can hurt, and I think that's where it basically boils down to. Give them a shot, see what happens. If it turns out to be a complete disaster in spring training because it just doesn't work, or the pitching suffers somehow, or whatever it can be, then you just go back to what you had originally planned. But at this point, you might as well try it.
All right, Sam, your thoughts.
Yeah, no, I'm right on with JT. So wait, Rich, first off, you don't miss Tim Burdick's WrestleMania? I mean, that, you know, that was some spring training fun. No, anyway. No, I completely agree. I think we're past the point with Kevin Plawecki and whether or not, like, it stunted a little bit of his development last year, just being up a little too early. You know, I think Sandy Alderson mentioned something like that. It's interesting for him, and I think he needs as many reps as possible. And it's clear that they're going with Travis Darno as their number one catcher. And so I think from the standpoint that Kevin needs to get better from a hitting standpoint, why not try him at first base, especially considering right now Wilmer Flores is our only backup first baseman, whereas last year we had Daniel Murphy, we had Michael Kadire, and probably another one person. So I think you got to start getting these guys reps there. I know they're talking about maybe the outfield, although that's rather crowded right now. You know, third base, I don't know. I know he was mentioning about David Wright. I can't picture anybody. I can't picture either Kevin Plawecki or Travis Darno at third base. But hey, if they want to send Kevin Plawecki out in the middle of a split squad game in Orlando, why not? Sure, try it. But yeah, I think that it's going to be important. Right now we're not talking about, you know, the fact that we have so much power at the position. We're not talking about that anymore, as we were going into 2013 when Anthony Recker first came around. You know, these are potentially two excellent starting catchers in Major League Baseball that we now have, and there's probably no set lineup. I mean, you know, they've been talking about how it's going to be interesting seeing what they keep together when David Wright's not in the lineup. My guess is Wilmer Flores will get most of those at bat. But especially because I think Sandy Alderson said something about not shifting Neil Walker and Asdrubal Cabrera around too much. But that's all another topic. I digress. I definitely would want to see Kevin Plawecki and Travis Darno. And let's not limit Travis Darno to just behind the plate. He should get some reps because it might help refresh him throughout the entire season.
Michael, what are your thoughts?
I'm conflicted, Rich. There's too much baseball that I've experienced in exposing players to other positions. I'm against it. I'm not inclined to expose either catcher to another position, first, third, outfield. I'm not interested in any of it. They're catchers by trade, and both of them, as far as I'm concerned, and I can't speak for the club, this is still an open competition. That said, yeah, this is Travis's job to lose, but no one has really seized the position yet and claimed it as their own. And that's why I feel it's still an open competition, and I think it should remain that way. And I think that's the condition that Terry Collins should set, just, you know, in search of maximizing either's potential at this point. The potential for a trade down the line shouldn't escape us, and that's why I think we should leave both of them behind the plate. You know what? This may not be popular to say, but I'm actually even inclined to have Plawecki start the year at AAA again, just for the sake of playing regularly. And that would create a scenario where the Mets would have to go out and find, you know, a suitable backup. Between
Does anybody
now and
know whether
day.
Monell is still on the team?
You know what? I don't know. I can't answer that, but I think it's inconsequential. He wouldn't fit the bill. We probably need somebody a little bit more established in that regard, but obviously not too costly. But, you know, but that's just a ramble. I'm just not inclined to opening up our catches to another position.
You know what, Mike? I'm not either, and maybe it's because you and I come from the same era, but I think about Todd Hundley, and, you know, for those who remember that, when he tried to play left field, it's just, it never, I don't want to say never and be absolute about it, but it seems like when you take a guy in the major league level and try to introduce him to a new position, with rare exception, like Cal Ripken became a good third baseman after being a shortstop, so every now and then you might see it. Gary Carter would play a little first base back in the days when there were doubleheaders, when the Expos wanted to get his bat in the lineup in the second game, they'd play him at first. So it can happen where they could fill in admirably in another position. But for every one of those, there are probably 10 situations where it simply doesn't work. The ball seems to find that person out of position, and it ends up costing you the game. Now, obviously, that's an overreaction on my part, but I'm just not a fan of doing it. I would rather go down the path Mike is talking about, where if it's about trying to get additional at-bats for one of the catchers, let Plawecki start at AAA and get a 35-year-old backup in here, something like that. That's just the path I would rather go, rather than exposing these guys to other positions. You know, this isn't a camp tryout. These are National League champions, so they have to have this stuff figured out. I'm not really interested in watching these guys learn new positions, spring training or not. That's my rant. I'm sorry. That's just a personal opinion.
Monell is on the club, just to make sure we clarify that. Monell did sign with a minor league deal with the Mets in January, so he is available.
Thank you, JT. Yes, I thought he was, and thank you for confirming that. Before going to our next question, we have a caller on the line. We have a 631 number, which I believe is Suffolk County. So, caller, can you identify yourself? Hello, caller, are you there?
Hello?
Yes.
Oh,
you're on
sorry.
The Rising Apple Report.
Sorry about that.
No problem. What's your question? What do you want to talk about?
About with the Kansas City Royals for opening day and stuff. Why are they making the Mets watch two World Series things? And any chance the Mets would throw Noah Syndergaard in to get some revenge?
Okay, good question. What's your name, sir?
Michael.
Michael. Okay, I'm not sure if any of you guys want to take that, but let me just give a little backdrop. The Royals are actually doing two separate ceremonies. One is going to be raising the flag on opening night, and another one is their ring ceremony, which kind of sounds like high school, but that's a different issue. They're doing their ring ceremony on the Tuesday night game, too. So the Mets are going to have to watch both of those. So I'll throw it out to our panel. We have Sam, we have JT, and we have Mike. Do you guys have any comment on
that? I'll start with that. And first off, Michael, I think you're not a first-time long-time. You're a long-time long-time, so we appreciate
you
continuing to call in. Firstly, this is all around one of the weirdest first weeks I've ever seen where they have, I think they have like 3 days off. And so they were originally supposed to play that Monday, but now they have Monday off because it got pushed to Sunday night. And then they play Tuesday, and then they're off Wednesday. And then Thursday, Friday, I think they even might have like 2 days off if they go right to Friday, which is really weird. But I guess it's going to be a good thing for stretching the arms. Anyway, regarding the ceremonies, I mean, I think it's a good motivator. Their explanation about, you know, I don't think the intention was to make the Mets watch it twice. It sounds like because the Sunday ESPN game gets a little complicated. They knew that they were going to have some people who wish they had seen certain things. All right. I think the explanation was they won't be able to see the pregame ceremonies on ESPN, but they will be able to see on Tuesday night, they'll be able to broadcast their pre-ceremonies on their main network in Kansas City. So that's one of the motivations, is to just include as many fans as possible. I think that there's probably still going to already be some bad blood between these two teams without even them, you know, talking about it, because they were still not a fan of what Noah Syndergaard did. I think Syndergaard might, I mean, right now it's probably Harvey and Jacob at the top of the rotation. So Syndergaard's probably not going to get, he's probably not going to face the Kansas City Royals at all. So I think because they're inclined to continue keeping him on track for whatever start he's going to make, Michael, I don't think you're going to see Noah Syndergaard in any of those Kansas City games.
JT or Mike?
Yeah, I think they should bring I just think they should bring Noah Syndergaard for the first pitch, and that's it. Just bring him for the first pitch, let him throw a first pitch to Escobar, and then
up
take
my
baby,
up and in.
That's it.
Mike?
Retribution would be folly. I don't even think it should enter any Mets mindset. But think of the whole situation from the frame of mind of an owner. You know, A, they're trying to spread the wealth of ceremony to more fans and doing it over the course of 2 days. I can see that. But first and foremost, you know, what happens after opening day to any team? Game two, there's always a dramatic fall off in attendance. So they're just trying to hedge themselves, you know, and trying to find a mean attendance figure for their series.
I can't say that I disagree with what my colleagues have said. Michael, I really don't think that the Royals are doing this to stick it in the Mets' face in any way, shape, or form. I really think that think about what the Mets did. They had opening day last year, then they pitched Harvey in the second home game. And they set the rotation up that way. And we all know why they did that. They did that because the second game at home, which I believe was a Tuesday night, wouldn't have drawn anybody. But it drew a lot of people because Matt Harvey pitched. They had their drawing card and they used it. And I think the Royals are basically saying, look, we could milk the crap out of this thing. We could do two nights of ceremonies and fill this place on a night when we might not normally do that. So I don't think it's about sticking it in the Mets' face as it is about trying to monetize the event and put as many people in the ballpark as possible. So, Michael, from Long Island, thank you for calling the Rising Apple Report once again, and have a great night.
You too.
Bye now.
I have to go after this, so I will segue out with this. That was one of the weirder games I've ever seen in person. That included, I believe, Chase Utley took him deep in the first inning, and obviously, you know, he was trying to just get his feet wet back in New York. So David Wright went down. I believe Michael Kadire had his knee busted up a little bit on a pitch. I mean, they won that game, and Yuris Familia gave a home run up in the ninth inning, but still held on for the save, as we all know, because it was part of the 11-game winning streak. But that game was juiced, but still one of the weirdest games I've ever seen live. But it was a lot of fun still. It was nice to see Matt Harvey back, and it was nice to see the crowd the way the crowd was. And with that, everybody, I will bid you adieu. Enjoy. JT, thanks again. And Rich, thanks for hosting on.
Take care. Thanks, Sam. Thanks for calling in.
Peace.
Take care, Sam.
All right, gentlemen, Mike and JT, let's go to our next topic we wanted to talk about tonight. And that is camp is very quiet. You know, there are no position battles, none that I could think of. We'll get to the bench a little bit later, but there are no position battles that I could think of going on. So let me ask you this question, and Michael, go to you first. Would you like to see a little healthy competition in Port St. Lucie, or do you go the other way and say that, you know what, when you don't have position battles, that means you have a really set team, and that's a good thing? What are your thoughts?
We're in a strange place, aren't we, Rich? It's been a long time. I'm okay without this lack of, you know, overwhelming competition. It's fine. Like I said, last year was a tremendous learning experience. You know, for some teams last year, you know, a scenario like that could turn into a minimal experience. Let's say they get wiped out in the first round. But like I said, that wasn't the case. And we're dealing with a lot of young pitchers who showed a lot of fortitude and a lot of maturity in pressure-packed situations. So I'm not worried about these guys. I think most important is that they set their frame of mind. You know, Yogi Berra said it best. And how did he phrase it? You know, it escapes me at the moment. Half this game is physical. 90% of this game is physical. The other half is mental. So that's where my concern is, making sure that these guys are in the proper frame of mind and to pay attention to detail and don't overlook anything, don't assume anything. Just go out there and grind every game out, every inning, every at-bat, as Boomer likes to say in the morning. And that's it. You know, as a former military man, it's all in preparation. The 7 P's, and I didn't get this from the military, and I wish I can credit who I can give this to, but it escapes me. But nevertheless, here it is. Proper prior planning prevents piss-poor performance. No, live it.
I like that.
And that's where I'm at. So no, I'm not worried. I'm not even slightly, you know, riddled with anxiety over this lack of, you know, competition in camp. Just get this thing done right, and it starts on day one.
I don't think any of us want a piss poor performance. I like that one a lot. So, JT, what are your thoughts on it? Would you like to see a little bit of little healthy competition, or are you good?
I'm good. No, I'm completely and totally good because there is there's something just excellent about everybody, about all of us as fans, knowing roles and knowing who's going to be where, barring any injury, something crazy happening. Everybody has a role. And what they should be doing. I personally just want spring training to go as smoothly, as quickly, as fun as possible. Like, just get your work done, get your at-bats in, get your innings pitched. Nobody get hurt. We're good. Just get to the regular season. It's a very strange time for us as Met fans, having a team that's this good and that's this solid all around. No complaints for me. It's a nice breath of fresh air to just not have to worry about that and not have to have anybody try too hard or maybe, get injured because they were trying to leg out a single into a double that maybe just really was a bad idea just because they felt like they needed that extra base hit to prove that they could play a position better than somebody else. I don't know. I wanted to just be more relaxed. Do your best. It's spring training. It's a month. And just let's get to the regular season.
You know, Rich, I wish I could have kept it as succinctly as JT did. Everyone knows their role. He nailed it. Everyone knows their role heading into the season.
And I think that's a good thing. You know, there are very few spots open on the roster. Everybody does know their role. You know, if you think about it, Addison Reed, your eighth inning guy, you know, you've got you've got Bastardo as your crossover guy. You know, I think if you talk to any one of these, even the bullpen guys, which is they're usually the last roles to settle in, even they know what they're supposed to do. And I agree with you guys. Healthy competition is for teams trying to figure it out. This team figured it out. This team just needs to finish the job. And I like the fact that they're in this spot. So I think we're all we're unanimous on that one. So in keeping with that theme, the bullpen. If there are 30 podcasts going on simultaneously right now for every team, they're all talking about their bullpens. It's just the way it is. If you're the Yankees, you're talking about how great it is. If you're other teams, you're talking about how you're trying to figure it out. The Mets bullpen. When people say, is there an Achilles heel on the Mets, most will say it could be before you get to Bastardo, Reed, Familia. It could be that could be the soft underbelly for those rock and roll fans. Of the team. So, JT, I'll go to you first. Give me your assessment on how comfortable you are with the bullpen right now, and then how you might try to address those middle innings.
I'm very, very comfortable with the bullpen right now. I mean, going through the end of last year and just how it felt that, you know, getting that bridge to Familia was at a time of struggle, especially in the World Series. That was, I think, that really scarred me for a long time. I think the bullpen is going to be not only good enough, but I think it could potentially be a strength for the Mets in the season. Like you said, getting is that almost like, I don't want to say it's like long relief, but let's say somebody's only able to go three innings or something because they get shellacked, or maybe just a shorter inning, a lot of pitches, getting somebody into the sixth inning. That is, I guess it can be somewhat concerning, but at the same time, I'm not as worried about it, and it's hard to even explain why I'm not that worried. Maybe it's overconfidence in the pitching staff and starting rotation and thinking that they're not going to find themselves in too many situations where that is going to be an issue. And if that's the case, well, you know, my bad. I really like the starting rotation. So I'm not worried. It's very hard to almost put into words why I'm not, but it just that's the gut feeling that I'm going into the season with. And hopefully I'm not proven wrong. At least that's what I can say.
Well, yeah, and that's just it. I mean, the bullpens, like Sandy Alderson always says, bullpens are wild cards, you know. And I happen to think they have enough depth on this roster that they could cobble together good middle-inning relief. Between Robles, you have him, you have Gil Martin, you know, you have other guys down there. They have some good power arms. You have Goodell. I think they could put it together. I know some people just feel like they have to say something negative, so they go to the bullpen and say the middle relief will hurt them, but I don't think so. Mike, comments from you.
Well, I'm not overly preoccupied with the bullpen like seasons previous to this one. Like JT, I'm comfortable with our situation. I think whatever dilemma faces us, we can handle in-house. My main concern is that we're set up for April and to get through the first month of the season. As we know, bullpens are never the same once you come into August and September. So I fully expect it to change, but I'm preoccupied, I guess, if anything, with how we open April and what our situation will be then. We got some guys coming down the pipe, maybe. You know, Edgen might make his return. Montero might be available, and he might contribute something. You know, so we got something to work with here. No preoccupation. I wouldn't say I'm worry-free, just not overly preoccupied by it. I think we'll be okay. You know, the Yankees, they got the best bullpen as far as I can see right now, and everything else after that. You know, we're all in the same boat together, I think.
You're probably right. And at this point, I'd like to bring on our staff editor, Mr. Danny Abriano. Danny, how are you tonight?
Great. How's it going, Rich?
It's going well. It's going well. And you know, you called in right at the right time because the bullpen is it's at least the spot that people like to take shots at the Mets. So you've heard the conversation to this point, Danny. What are your thoughts on the bullpen? Are you confident, and how might you round it out, seeing that most of the pieces are in place, but how might you round it out going into April?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with what you guys have said so far. I mean, if you look at the back end, obviously Familia is there to close it out. And I think the acquisition of Bastardo is huge because he's not just a guy that can be a late-inning guy. He's a true crossover reliever. He can get out lefties. He can get out righties. He's proven. He's got great stuff. You have Reed coming back, and I think Robles is really primed for a great year. He was really, really good last year, had some trouble with the long ball, had some trouble with big innings. But I think the back end is going to be really good. And then you have Blevins as the true Lugi, the lefty one-out guy. And to round it out, it looks like we're going to have about two spots up for grabs come spring training. So you've got Goodell, you have Gil Martin, if you want somebody who's a true long man. And you've also got Montero, who I think, you know, it was kind of weird last year. He was looked at as somebody who had more of a phantom injury than an actual injury, so it's going to be interesting to see how he rebounds this year, if he does rebound. And you have Edgen coming back around May 1. So I think it would be nice if they got another proven guy for the pen, but I really don't think they need it. I think they have those five strong guys that are pretty much locks right now. And I think it's going to be, you know, just as the whole team is the strongest it's been since, I would say, 2006. The pen is going to be a strength for this team. I really think so.
Well, change is definitely on the book. I know what we won't be contending with, and that's Bobby Parnell and Henry Mejia. What a meathead. You know, so those are two anxieties that are gone.
Cheers to that.
it's a shame. It's a shame with Mejia. But,
what a meathead.
You know, it's incredible. And I said it the day it broke. It would have been shocking if he hadn't done it the second time around, but it was just so weird. And it almost makes you think that something strange is going on and not just, you know, the fact that he tested positive three times, but something weird has to be going on with that guy. It just makes absolutely no sense.
But these are some real archaic steroids that he's being accused of taking.
Horse
almost
steroids,
for like horses,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, and the one thing I'm going to give, I'm not giving him a pass necessarily, but the one thing I'm going to say in his defense is this particular steroid, from what I understand, or PD, whatever you want to call it, is an older one, like you guys have said, but it's one that lasts in the body a long time. So I'm going to hold out 1% of hope that this is a positive test from something he may have done months and months ago. It's probably not the case, but I'm going to hold out hope because it's almost hard to fathom somebody being that tone deaf or just that blind to keep doing it. So I'm gonna give him that one shred, that one benefit of the doubt, that maybe someday it'll come out that he hadn't done it since his last suspension in July, and it was just some lingering amount that was in his bloodstream. Again, maybe it's a pipe dream, maybe it's giving him too much of the benefit of the doubt, but I'll hold that out as a hope here. But yeah, it's shocking and it's sad, really. When you watch the highlights of him closing out those games, you know, and doing the stomp and all that, you're like, this guy's a character. You know, he's colorful. He's going to be missed. So with that said, I want to move to our next topic. And Danny, I'm glad you're on because I want to go to you first on this one. The topic of Alejandro Diaz, and you know, Danny, you wrote a piece on the site just a couple days ago. It might have been maybe 4 or 5 days ago, about how when the Mets brought in Roger Bernardina, minor league contract, invite to Major League Spring Training, it didn't seem like you were too much in favor of that. And I read that and I said to myself, well, I actually see that differently. So I'm going to throw out my thought. I'd like to hear your thought back. So my thought on the whole Diaz thing is, if they could find a way to dump him in his $72.5 million, I see it as an opportunity for them to have that money available at the deadline. Now, Bernardine is a guy who, you know, I'm looking at his defensive stats in center field. His career run saved as a center fielder is -2. So that's, you know, that's not outstanding. And his career UZR 50 as a center fielder is -10.7. And that's actually pretty bad. But he is a center fielder. He's played a lot more center field and a lot more recently than Diaz. So my thought is, why not have your fifth outfielder be this guy who is more experienced in center field, probably would sign for the minimum, giving you more financial flexibility at the deadline as opposed to holding on to Diaz? And I completely respect your opinion. I think you saw it differently, but I just wanted to throw it out and maybe you could expand on that.
Sure. I mean, I see it two different ways. When you look at Bernardina, this is a guy that hasn't really had a positive impact in the majors since 2013, really 2012. So I'm taking it in more of an offensive point of view than an overall or defensive point of view. When you look at Diaz, at the time when he signed in December and it looked like the Mets were going to let Cespedes walk, my issue was that they brought in Diaz supposedly to be part of a platoon in center field, and he's a guy who hasn't played center field well since 2012. So that was my main issue with Diaz. It wasn't the fact that I didn't think he would be productive offensively. Because if you look at his stats last year, he hit very well against right-handed pitching. He hit .278, .351, .448 against righties. So this is a guy that can contribute offensively. My main issue with trading somebody like Diaz right now is that they're very, very thin when it comes to outfield depth. The only guy they have who's not expected to make 25-man roster is Brandon Nimmo. And Nimmo has been underwhelming the last few years in the minors, and he's dealing with a torn tendon in his foot. So if they're going to trade Diaz, I would want to have somebody a little bit better Austin Bernardina ready to step in as that fifth outfielder. And I would also want a little bit more down on the farm in case somebody goes down with an injury. So, you know, I could see it. If they can get something of value for Deaza and I think they can find somebody to step in, maybe pull the trigger. But if it's just a salary dump, I really wouldn't be in favor of it. And, you know, they really should have some extra money to spend without having to get rid of the $5.75 million Deaza is making. But we'll see what happens. I mean, Sandy spoke a few weeks ago, and he kind of intimated that it wasn't something that was on the front burner, that it was something that maybe they'll ponder down the line as opening day draws closer. But we'll see how it shakes out.
Fair enough. Mike, your thoughts on that. Deaza, obviously the circumstances have changed dramatically since they signed him. So do you basically not worried about it, or would you like to see them? Where do you stand on Deaza? Do you think he has a spot on the team?
For the reason that you just said, I'm willing to give the Mets a pass on the fact that the situation is what it is. I think it was an unfortunate sequence of events. Things didn't follow more sequentially as the Mets would have liked. And what I mean by that, Kadarz retiring, then signing Deaza, then signing Yoenis Cespedes. I think had you been able to rearrange the sequence of all that, Deaza wouldn't be a Met today. So it is what it is. I'm prepared to go into the season with him in whatever manner the Mets use him, for as long as he's not a starter. That's where my main concerns are. So the fact that our outfield is pretty much set, to me, this is one of those secondary issues, Rich, that I'm okay with. And whichever way they go, should they go your preference or another route, let's just cross those bridges when we get to it. If they can negotiate a trade for him and patch up, per se, the bullpen or solidify another situation, I'm for it. So I'm open. And like I said, I'll give the organization a pass in the fact that he kind of sticks out like a sore thumb right now. But again, the sequence didn't quite work out the Mets' way in that scenario.
You know, it's interesting. When you're talking about your biggest problem or something we're actually spending time talking about is probably the 25th man on the roster, isn't that just indicative of having a good baseball team going into spring training?
It really is.
Have this conversation. JT, your thoughts. Not a big deal. Do you have a solid thought one way or the other on Deaza and how they might want to approach that?
To be honest, I'm pretty much with everybody on board in this case, in the sense that I wouldn't mind keeping him around. I keep thinking about if they were to trade him for something other than cash relief or something, I don't really see an area where you could put him that he wouldn't already be helping out. So, for example, you would almost need to trade him for another outfielder because you want to have some type of outfield depth just in case somebody goes down with an injury or something happens. Obviously, you have Lagares there too, but it would be nice to have him. He's an expensive non-starter per se, I guess, in a way, but having him around, just it doesn't rub me the wrong way, and I'm meh. It happens. As long as he's not a starter, I don't really mind it. I think he could help out to give guys days off and stuff like that, but it's not something that's on my mind. And again, the fact that we're even discussing the 25th man on the roster is very, very calming going into spring training.
And
you're right.
True. And in the interest of fairness, let's throw this out there as well, that in years past, signing Deaza would have prohibited the Mets from signing Cespedes.
You're right.
100%. Yep.
We thought it did until the snowstorm day. We thought it actually did prohibit them. But they did us a solid and went out and got Cespedes. And I would agree with you guys in the sense that it's not something that keeps me up at night. It's just something that the minute they brought Bernardina in, the first thing I thought was, that's the end of Deaza. They brought him in to be an inexpensive fifth outfielder as opposed to an expensive one. Again, if they don't go that way, I really don't care. He's probably the better player.
Sorry to interrupt. What would you trade him for? What do you think, what need could the Mets fill with him gone?
To me, it would be salary relief, because I still think, although they're spending much more and that's great, I still think money is a factor in their decisions. And so if it means picking up a valuable piece at the deadline, and that 5.75, I think Danny said was the actual amount, if that becomes an issue and we can get rid of that salary so that money is available to bring in that piece at the deadline, that would be my only objective. Anything you'd bring back for Diaz would be insignificant. It would be a salary dump in my mind.
I think you're right.
I believe our caller, Michael, from Long Island, has rejoined us. So, Michael, welcome back to the he's coming on as we speak. Welcome back to the Rising Alpha Report. Just waiting for the microphone to go hot here on Michael. I think he wanted to add something on Diaz's. So while he's coming up, well, you know what? For some reason, he's not coming up at the moment. Here he is. So, Michael, welcome back. Did you have something you wanted to share with us on Diaz?
I would trade Diaz. Our minor league farm system isn't looking so hot right now compared to what it was. We need more minor leaguers. Yes, we have Nimmo, but he's hurt. But we need more minor leaguers. What are people ranking our system now? 16th or something? Do you know that exactly? What they're ranking it?
It's middle of the pack.
I don't, to be honest.
I'll jump in. It's 16, according to ESPN. But the reason it's 16 is because a whole bunch of guys graduated from the minors to the majors last year. And they also traded some guys in the Tyler Clifford deal, in the deals for Kelly Johnson and Juan Uribe. So they're middle of the pack right now, but they still have a whole bunch of high upside hitters, such as Rosario, Smith, even Cicchini. So it's still looking good, and they can replenish. They have two picks in the top 30, top 31 coming up. So they'll be fine as far as the minor leagues are concerned.
I just still think we should play it safe and get more minor leaguers. Get like one or two guys just to play it safe.
Well, that's always a concern. And Sandy talked about that. He talked about that when he was on Baseball Night in New York, about sustainability and how, you know, at some point you have to think about, okay, now we've traded the minor league pieces to bring in major league talent. That was the right thing to do. If you find yourself thin on the minor league level, you have to start thinking about sustainability, whether that's through drafting, whether it's through conservation of draft picks, not signing free agents, so this way you're holding on to your draft picks, whatever. But that's all part of the model. Now, whether or not Diaz would be the guy to bring back any kind of an impact minor league piece, I'd have to, you know, doubt that. But to bring back some depth, you know, bring back maybe an arm or two. It's interesting how Fulmer, who went in the Cespedes deal, from what I understand, is going to be battling for a spot in the Tiger rotation. So, you know, some of these guys the Mets have parted with, for good reason, are decent players. And at some point, you need to think about bringing those back. And whether or not Diaz does it, you know, is a different issue. So, guys, I wanted to go to another place here. And I wanted to, on the theme of depth, I wanted to go into the bench and the infield depth in particular. So, Danny, I'm going to start with you here. And so right now it looks like Wilmer Flores is the primary guy off the bench, which is fine. He's probably the most versatile. He's going to play a lot of first base from what Terry said in his pressure today. So that all sounds good. And then there's the issue of Ruben Tejada. Should he be the sixth infielder? Or, Danny, would you rather see them go in a different direction? Maybe it's another salary situation. Tejada's due $3 million this year. They have Matt Reynolds, who they want to give a look in the outfield. So can Reynolds become a super sub? So my two questions, same as the outfield, my two questions are you comfortable with the infield depth? And secondly, what might you do with Tejada? Or is it another one of those not too big of a concern?
Yeah, I'm definitely comfortable with the infield depth. And there have been some people worrying about who's going to back up first base. But there's two things there. First of all, due to last season against lefties was very, very productive. So even if he regresses a little bit, Flores is fine to step in and play against tough lefties at first base. So I'm not really worried about that. And when it comes to backup catcher, you've got Pawlecki, obviously, who's also going to get some time, probably at first base in the outfield. You have Lagares and Diaz to step into the outfield. And, yeah, I guess the question really is Tejada. Is he going to be the 25th guy? Or is he going to be somebody who they either cut toward the end of spring training and try to save some money or deal? And, you know, when you have Cabrera at short and you have Flores as main backup, you really don't need Tejada. He's kind of somebody who's a luxury at this point. So I can see them cutting him towards the end of spring training to save money. I can see them trying to trade him. And they can carry Reynolds as that 25th man. And he can play short. He can play second. They can probably slide him over to third, try him in the corner outfield. So I think that really is the only position battle right now. There's nothing else. When you go into spring training, it's really strange. The last few years, especially going back like 4 or 5 years, you would go into spring training not knowing who was going to be playing center field, not knowing who's going to win the first base job, who's going to be the catcher. And this year, it's basically the 25th man and maybe one or two bullpen guys. So it's a really interesting thing going into this spring training, but I think it really comes down to what they want to do with Tejada. And I kind of think he's going to be dealt, but, you know, if somebody gets hurt, you're going to need somebody to step in. I don't know if you want Flores stepping in if Cabrera goes down. So he is a luxury, but he's also somebody that you really can't replace easily.
You know, I agree with that, actually. I'd like to see them move past Tejada and give Matt Reynolds a shot. Now, there's that old adage about you don't want to take a guy from the minor leagues and put him on the major league bench, but Reynolds isn't considered a major prospect in the organization. Maybe this is his role. Maybe he is a major league utility player. And if you can get him at $500,000 versus $3 million for Tejada, and Reynolds, he's probably a better stick. He has better speed. And if he's a little bit more versatile, if he could play a little outfield, I think the writing might be on the wall for Tejada if Reynolds shows that he can hit in spring training and he shows at least some aptitude in the outfield to be that guy who, you know, in the 18-inning game, you could stick out there in an emergency. So it might be an opportunity for Reynolds. And his opportunity with the Mets might be closing pretty quickly. This might be his last opportunity to make the roster. And if so, it would come at the expense of Tejada. So, Mike, your thoughts on this. Your thoughts on the infield depth and how might you handle the Tejada situation?
I'll say that it's strange that Terry Collins and Ruben Tejada seem inseparable. It's like that father-son relationship. And I don't know if Sandy Alderson will ever separate them. But back to reality, you know, there's something to be said for out with the old and in with the new. But the ultimate question is how much of a premium do the Mets place on late inning defense? And I think that will ultimately answer the question whether Tejada stays or goes. But again, you know, there's something to be said for moving on. And I'm not averse to playing Reynolds or giving him that opportunity, as you say, to be the backup. Perhaps that is his role in waiting. So I'm good. Again, these are good problems to have. So, you know, whichever way, well, no, I won't leave it that slipshod. But, you know, I think we'll ultimately get a good resolution to this situation. To Tejada. You know, he's been here a while. It's hard to see guys go, but, you know, it's a cold business, and sometimes you have to let go in order to move on.
JT?
I feel the same way. I mean, I think Tejada is one of those players that became a fan favorite, even though he didn't, like, dominate. He had a pretty good stick at times, and he, you know, his defense has been pretty solid. Not known for speed or anything like that, but you know, after the whole Chase Utley thing last year in the NLDS, he just everybody loved Tejada. So it's always tough to part with players that are fan favorites, I guess, in that sense. But you know, the logic is just what it is. You know, it is a business, so you have to make the decisions that are best for the ball club. And I think the argument that you guys have made for Matt Reynolds is pretty solid. I don't think it can get better than that. The guy has to get that chance to be able to even maybe do a little outfield play time and share it with guys, you know, on a need-to basis. And I would. It would suck just because, in the sense that, again, he's a fan favorite. He's a personal favorite of mine. I've liked Tejada since he came up, but it is time to move on. And I expect them to do that, actually, knowing Sandy Alderson and knowing that he's just not going to necessarily keep unnecessary salary on the payroll if it's just not needed. I definitely expect them to do something similar to that. If they didn't, though, I don't think it would surprise me. But I guess we'll see. I don't feel very strongly either sense. I trust that whichever way they go, will be a pretty good decision in that sense.
You know, I agree with you. I can't see Sandy Alderson keeping $3 million on the bench in a player who brings what Tejada brings. Not that he's a bad player, not that he's a bad backup. I just can't – it doesn't seem consistent with the Sandy way of building a team.
Right.
And I feel the same about Deazza, so I think there's a chance they're both gone, but we'll see. We'll have to see how it plays out. And I believe Michael's still with us. So, Michael, did you have a comment on the infield depth?
Yeah. I say get rid of Tejada. I never liked that guy. You're also forgetting Dylan Herrera. I like the potential he has. You could bring him up here, have him on the bench. Because what's it worth for a $3 million bench player or however much Herrera is getting paid right now? We saw the pop he had in Cincinnati last year. So he has potential, and he's fast too, which we need.
Yeah, and Herrera is somebody that I think his year is 2017. Neil Walker is going to cost a lot of money when his contract's up at the end of this year, and I do think the Mets see Herrera as getting that final piece of seasoning, whether it comes in AAA, which likely most of it will, or a little bit in Queens, getting that final piece of seasoning in 2016, and I do see him as a second baseman of the future. And to your point, you know, if he can get a little taste of the major leagues this year, another small taste of it, that just makes him that much more primed for that role in 2017. So, guys, we're at the top of the ninth here. We have two more things to do before we call it a night. So the first one is Jeurys Familia. Now, let's think about his career trajectory, right? He's a guy who was a starter, made him a reliever. And Mejia was the closer. Familia was the eighth inning guy. We loved him as an eighth inning guy. Mejia has his issues. Familia becomes the closer. He doesn't become a good closer. He becomes an outstanding closer. The guy is downright filthy, as we all know. So Familia's gone from this quiet guy who, you know, kind of stayed in Mejia's shadow. They're good friends. We all know that. To a point where Familia's now, he's going to have his own entrance music, a customized song. So what do you think about, Danny, going to go to you first on this one. Not so much the song itself, but Familia's meteoric rise through the organization from a guy who wasn't cutting it as a starter to a 40-plus save closer who gets his own song. So what are your thoughts on that? Isn't that amazing how Familia's done all this?
It really is, and it's been great to watch. You know, Familia always had the stuff, but it was Mejia who came up, obviously, before him, 2010-11. He was about 20 years old. Mejia burst on the scene first. Familia didn't get his first date until 2012. Really didn't do much until 2014. But when you look at Familia, this is just somebody who's never flustered on the mound. Even when he blows a save, even when he's getting touched up a bit, which is a rarity, he just keeps it all under control. He never looks like he's flustered. And, you know, when you look at somebody like Familia, he's got just an unbelievable arsenal. And when you have a fastball in the upper 90s, it's diving away from hitters. It's just absurd. And yeah, it's been a meteoric rise. But, again, this guy has always had the stuff to do this. And I think, you know, as unfortunate as it's been to watch Mejia go from somebody who was maybe a high upside number two type starter, then a bullpen piece, to now banned from baseball for life, you can kind of say that maybe it was a blessing in disguise, that if not for Mejia's, whatever it was, his idiocy or his horrible, horrible luck, Familia wouldn't have emerged. And now he has, and the Mets have a young, inexpensive, dominant closer. And it's a tremendous asset. And if you look at the kind of deals that were made this offseason, look at the Craig Kimbrell trade, look at the guys he brought back. A closer like this is incredibly valuable, and for the Mets to have one is just great. And I love that he's going with it. He's got his own interest music coming up this year, and you know I'm really excited to see how he does this season.
Me too. And so JT, from your perspective, is Familia, you know, part of the woodwork now, where you just, okay, great, we have a great closer, or do you at times step back and say to yourself, my God, look what we have here. David Ortiz called him the nastiest reliever in baseball. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
It's just the sheer luck. I guess you could say luck, talking about going from Mejia to Familia, but also just the idea of being able to have both of these guys, and then when one of them just has a catastrophic failure, as Mejia has had, and then but at the same time being able to still rely on this second guy who probably has been better than what we could have expected, or any of us could have expected, even from Mejia, is just it's incredible. So you have to feel very blessed, very lucky to be able to have had a situation like this. I find it awesome that he's working with one of my favorite bachata artists from Dominican Republic. He is doing something that I think is pretty cool, and the fact that it'll be something that the quote that I wrote in the post about this was that he says it's bachata, the style of music, is since it's from his Dominican Republic, it's something from home, and it's something that he carries with him. So it is very relaxing. For a closer, you have these kind of, Enter Sandman, or you have these, like, hard songs, whether it's, whether it's a Latin reggaeton or something, harder to kind of get everybody pumped up. Whereas bachata is more of a, it's not slow by any stretch of the imagination, but it is more calm and comforting in that sense. So it'll be interesting to see him come into that. But at the same time, I completely understand his thinking of making this walk-up song. And I think it's going to be something cool for the for Met fans that get to experience that, not only with Cespedes comes up to bat, but also when Familia comes in from the bullpen, having a cool little custom song that that nobody really knows. So I was a fan of that. I was really, really happy to see that happen. So, and it goes hand in hand with his ability to just surprise us and continue surprising us with his stuff and with his composure and his ability to just perform under pressure like he has. So I'm a huge fan of his.
Very well said. Mike, Mr. LeConlin, what do you think?
I'm sitting here laughing. Rich, you and I go back to a day. We saw Tug McGraw. We saw Raleigh Fingers. And then we saw Goose Gossage and all those guys emerge. It's a little weird, isn't it, that, being eccentric or outlandish is almost prerequisite for being a closer? It seems that's always been the case. Familia, he's big. He's imposing. He's got nasty stuff. As Danny said, he's composed. And he conducts himself like a professional. This is what February is all about, enjoying the moment and forecasting what's, going to unfold this season. Who knows? I'll just say this. What we have in film, we don't know. That's how quirky relievers are. We don't know what we have. Nor did the Yankees. And I love throwing this out there. And it's totally unfair to Familia to compare him to Mo. Mariano Rivera. But Mariano Rivera was a failed starter in 95. And then he got totally abused by Joe Torre in 96, serving as a setup man to John Wetland. And then in 97, when he was handed the closer's job, if anybody out there remembers, he gave up that home run to the Cleveland Indians that eliminated the Yankees from the 97 playoffs. The rest, as we say, is history, which is to say, we never know. We just never know. Am I comparing him to Mo? Absolutely not. That would be ridiculous. But my point is, we just never know. Right now, we think we got a very good closer on our hands with the potential to do, damage in the historic context that this guy can have a lot of highlights in italics on the back of his baseball card when he's all said and done.
Excellent. So, all right, guys, we're down to the last segment of the show. And what we'll do here is we'll go to our final thoughts for the night. We like to call it the last word, final thought, whatever it might be. So the order we'll go to here, we'll start with Mike, we'll go to JT, then we'll have Danny wrap it up. So, Mike, here we are. It's February 18th. It's Pitcher and Catcher Day. It's National Wine Day, all those things we talked about earlier. What are your thoughts? What do you want to leave the listeners with about your thoughts going into spring training on day one of spring training, the 2016 Mets? Go.
Act like you've been there before. That's it, Rich. Usually I ramble on in our final word. But, you know, we're New Yorkers. We have a long, long National League history. And the Mets are only the latest incarnation of that. Okay? We are the defending National League champions. Let's compose ourselves as players and fans alike in a manner representative of our rich baseball heritage and history. Act like you've been there before, okay? And by that I mean we're not a bunch of amateurs. Even though we haven't enjoyed a lot of success lately, and I get it, we're feeling giddy about ourselves. But let's not show up to the ballpark this season and be obnoxious about it. So, you know, just a shot across the bow in February.
But I think, you know, I think what you're saying, Mike, it applies to the guys on the field, too, like you're saying. It's a thing we started
the podcast with. Players and fans alike, man.
Play with swagger, not with confidence. And I think your point is very well taken. I think that that's a, something they should have in mind is play like you've been there before. Play like you are the National League champions because you are. But don't get so cocky and think that you're entitled to go back because that's where it crosses the line. And I think you said it very succinctly, and I like it. So, JT,
can I add in on that?
Go. It's your turn for your final thoughts. You can add in. You can have your own thoughts. Whatever you want to do.
I just want to add in on the don't get too cocky thing. Remember what Bryce Harper said last season? Give me my rings now. He didn't even make it to the playoffs. So, don't get too cocky. Have fun out there, but do your job also. So that's my
agree. So, Danny, I know you bleed blue and orange as much as anyone. What are your thoughts on day one of spring training?
You know, my thoughts on day one, we've waited so long. Obviously, it's been less time than we usually wait since we made it to November, Game 5 of the World Series. And now that it's here, I'm kind of already thinking ahead to opening day. So, before skipping all the way to opening day, my final word tonight will be 14. 14 days from today, there's the first spring training game against the Nats in Vieira. And I think that's when we'll really start to feel that this season is getting underway. And I really can't wait for it to get started. And ever since the loss, you know, I'm thinking back to how they've had leads. They had leads in every single game of the World Series. They really could have won it. If you look at game four, if you do something that's proper and you don't have Tyler Clifford in the game, you probably win. If you pull Harvey, that's the first batter gets on in the ninth inning in game five, you probably win. And it's just so difficult, no matter how good you are, to get back to the World Series, much less win it. So I just want this team to get underway. I want them to get off to a good start. I want them to get back and close this thing out. And I just kind of I hate to want to skip months and erase days off the calendar, but I really am just ready for the season to start, and I think it's going to be a really special one.
From your lips to God's ears, Danny. My final thought would be focus. And I think I said this closing the last podcast, but what I mean by that is unfinished business. Have that implanted in your brains, guys. You guys, but more importantly the Mets, have unfinished business in indelible ink on your foreheads, and everything you do bubbles up to that objective. So when it's the middle of March and it's getting hot in Florida and you're doing PFP again, think about it. You're doing this because you have unfinished business. When it's the middle of July and it's 95 degrees at Citi Field and a day game on getaway day, win that game because you have unfinished business. Everything you do from today, hopefully through November, goes right up. The arrow points right at that statement of unfinished business, and that's your mantra. That's your true north, whatever other cliche you want to talk about. That's what it's all about, finishing the job. So with that said, I would like to thank Danny, JT, Mike, and our caller Michael for joining us tonight on the Rising Apple Report. I think the shows will become more numerous now that the games are about to start and certainly once the season starts. So, gentlemen, it's been a lot of fun. I want to thank you and say baseball's here. Let's go Mets. Have a great night, everybody.
Good night, boys.
Night, guys.
Good night.